St. Nicky did the same for Will. We both still rave about each other's EAs. Pro tip, if you can afford an exec admin, get to it. You'll boost your productivity threefold, I promise. I got mentored by Will's team members in how they did many of their client projects and how they used software, including Moz's tools and several of our competitors', in their processes. With help from Sears CFO, Larry Waddell, I dug into how they attracted customers and how they managed the complexities of waxing and waning client demand. I learned about Sears' finances and their management structure, about their promotion criteria, and their team's strengths and weaknesses. I even had an unexpected meeting crop up on Thursday, during which one of Will's employees turned in her 2 weeks' notice. Remarkably enough, the same thing happened to Will in Seattle, as one of Moz's senior engineers announced his intention to leave. We didn't just do each other's jobs. We lived the other's life. Geraldine and I volunteered at the Ronald McDonald House in Philly, a commitment Will had made months earlier. I attended his monthly meeting with Covenant House, a charity that helps homeless youth get housing and support services. We ate dinners with Will's wife, Nora, who couldn't participate in the swap due to work. I fed Coltrane and took her to the office. On Monday, everything felt awkward. But by Friday, both of us and our respective teams had reached a surprising level of comfort and normalcy with the swap. I sat in on meetings with Google's advertising team and pitched Sears services to a pair of potential clients. They closed one deal but lost the other. Several Sears employees took me under their wings, showing me the processes they'd built and explaining the ins and outs of their site audits, their keyword research processes, how they manage client ad spend accounts, and more. I watched Sears consultants use tools. Sometimes it was Moz's. Sometimes our competitors'. Two things stood out. First, it was clear that every data point needed validation. If Moz's tool said there was a link from site A to site B, or that page X had a particular problem, the consultant would go check manually that there was indeed a link from A to B, or that the problem on X was the one we reported. Only after they confirmed the tool reports with spot checks would they start to trust the results and assume accuracy. And if they found discrepancies, they'd switch to another tool, or worse, to an entirely manual process. Second, in every case where SEER consultants were using tools, they'd happily switch from one hyper-specialized solution to another. If Moz's keyword data wasn't ideal, they'd use SEMrush or Ubersuggest or Google AdWords. If our link data wasn't comprehensive, they'd move to Ahrefs or Majestic. There seemed to be no loyalty between tool providers and no barrier or switching costs from having to change up the UI, log into a different tool, pay another monthly fee, or get data in another format. The benefits I thought an all-in-one tool set created were being dismantled before my eyes. That exposure to Will's professional life and to Sears' inner workings was transformative. What started as a bit of a gimmick emerged as possibly the most intense, high-speed course in customer empathy imaginable. Instead of merely watching customers use our products or interviewing them about their work, I was living their lives, eating, sleeping, and breathing the challenges of an SEO agency. That week impressed upon me how different reality was from my expectations. And, along with the poor reception of Moz Analytics, made me question everything I'd assumed I knew about the web marketing industry. I desperately needed that humbling. I only wish it could have come sooner. It was too late to change the scope of launch and impossible to go back in time to warn my colleagues and myself that we were embarking on a voyage without the necessary compass. But that week in Will's shoes made me more thoughtful about every plan and product I've committed to since. No longer do I trust solely my own judgment. I validate not just with interviews and testing, but by forcing myself to do the work, by using our competition's products to accomplish those tasks, and by spending time with my industry compatriots, often while on the road for conferences and events, to share, side by side, working time with them on real projects. Another big change I made was a return to the consulting world. Though I didn't charge for my assistance, exposure to Seer made me realize how crucial it was that I didn't just theorize and prognosticate, but actually got my hands dirty. Most of the projects I take on now are either nonprofits or via personal and professional friends I'm seeking to help. Often, a half-day session with a team of marketers at a startup will uncover a huge blind spot in our tools or in the universe of available tools, and I'll return to Moz with a half-baked idea I can validate over and over before deciding if it was something real and worthy of pursuit or just a one-time problem. If life swapping isn't an option, many paths exist to live the lives of your customers. But before you can do any of them, you need to know these people as people, not as personas or sales targets. I've found repeatedly that when our product and engineering teams comb through user interview or review data, we tend to create features and products that are barely better than the already established processes our customers are using. I think this happens because of how we've been socialized and trained to use data in professional environments. We see numbers, we analyze them, and we make decisions based on how those numbers lean. Say you're tasked with making software to help people manage their finances. You survey a large group of people about their spending habits, what they want to track, what information they need to be informed about, and where they have financial analysis pain today. The surveys and interviews reveal the 10 most important categories of spending and that the proportion of spending over time and the absolute amount spent are both important. Thus, you create the same app that nearly every major bank and credit card has today to serve this purpose. But if you knew the people personally and spent time with them while they did their banking, financial management, and planning tasks, you might find that post-spending analysis isn't nearly as important or helpful as alerts before they spend, tracking progress against goals, or incentivizing healthy spending and saving behavior. Side note, yes, I realize that these types of features might dissuade a person from spending as much, running counter to the financial institution's goals of getting them to spend more, and hence won't be popularized in their feature sets. Facebook had a great example of this several years back. Internal data showed Facebook that many users love to reminisce by viewing photos from years past. The high engagement rate these photos received prompted the social network to launch a new feature called Your Year in Review. The feature was beloved by many, but also made headlines in the press because for some users who'd had tragic events, it was an unexpected, heartbreaking and painful experience. Eric Meyer famously wrote a blog post called Inadvertent Algorithmic Cruelty about the experience of losing his daughter, then seeing Facebook push photos and stories of her to him at unexpected times. The data was clear, but empathy for the real-life experiences of a crucial subset of Facebook's customers was missing. I want to believe that if an engineer on the Facebook Year in Review product had shared experiences like Eric's, or if they'd known people who did, that feature would have launched with some preventative logic built in for those who'd experienced tragedy like his. How do you get to an empathetic place for product design and development? Create regular customer exposure for your team and yourself. That exposure can come through extreme efforts like my CEO swap with Will, or it can come from more subtle actions. Here's a few that have worked particularly well for Moz's product folks and for other startups I've worked with. First, conferences and events. I get a lot of marketing value from speaking at events, but equally valuable is the exposure to professionals in our field who need and use the tools we offer. Hallway conversations, session Q&As, coffee meetings, and after-hours hangouts offer a wide range of experiential cases from which you can gain perspective and insight. Just be sure to have a few consistent, open-ended questions that get to the core of your customer empathy issues. Second, volunteering, apprenticeships, or internships. A handful of startup founders and startup product owners have taken the innovative step of volunteering a day, a week, or even a few months through an apprenticeship or internship, formally or informally, with their customers in order to learn what their day-to-day work, challenges, and current solutions look like. If you're in the early stages and have the ability to be the customer you're going to serve, even for a very limited period of time, I highly recommend it. Third, paid or pro bono consulting. This is how Moz got its start. We were consultants first, built software that we ourselves needed, and then opened it up to a broader audience we'd built via our blog. Nowadays, I do this through pro bono consulting, and several of Moz's other product contributors still do some independent paid consulting. It's true that consulting doesn't always provide perfect insight into the issues or work faced by your target customers, unless they too are consultants. But it can contribute experiences and build relationships you otherwise couldn't get. Fourth, teaching. Not only does teaching require you to understand a subject or process deeply, it also gives you exposure to a wide range of practitioners or future practitioners of your subject matter. Those relationships bolster empathy as you show folks the what and how behind a process. It's no surprise that so many professors and educators are recruited as startup advisors. Fifth, hiring or contracting. If you or your current team have no bandwidth or no passion for embedding yourselves into your customer processes, there's no shame in recruiting to help fill this gap. We've done this many times at Moz, hiring SEO professionals who know the field well and have used dozens of tools for years to assist us in building better software for customers like them. The key is identifying those individuals who can translate their own problems into more global solutions and have a product-driven mindset rather than focusing exclusively on their own processes. We've done best with this through the worlds of social media and blogging, identifying folks whose public contributions to the field clearly show an affinity for holistic, empathetic pattern matching and helping the industry as a whole. Thankfully, after learning from my mistakes with Moz Analytics, a couple of years later, I was given a second chance to build a new product. In this next chapter, I'll walk you through how we did it and try to reverse engineer why it worked so well. Chapter 12. Great products are rarely minimally viable. If you are not embarrassed by the first version of your product, you've launched too late. That's Reid Hoffman, March 2011. In the past decade, the lean startup movement has had, arguably, a greater impact on the approach that product designers, engineers, and entrepreneurs take than any other. The fundamental concept is undeniably compelling. Craft a version of your product and company that requires the least amount of time and effort to validate whether the problem you're solving is an important one that real customers will pay for or use. This minimum viable product will help you learn faster, iterate faster, and survive longer on less money. It's a powerful way to overcome many of the problems that plague and often prematurely kill young companies and new product efforts. But it also leads people to create a lot of crappy, barely useful products. We'll learn a lot once the MVP's out. In late 2014 and early 2015, I worked with Moz's big data and data science teams designing a minimum viable product, MVP, to help people identify websites that Google might consider to be spam. We started with a few assumptions about the field of web spam and SEO that we then validated through research and customer interviews. First, getting links from spam sites can potentially harm rankings and visibility in Google. Second, knowing which sites are spam is hard because Google won't label them. If they did, spammers could easily see what passes Google's filters and what doesn't. Third, if you take the time to perform searches in Google related to a website and see that it doesn't rank for any terms and phrases that it obviously should. For example, if Moz.com didn't rank on the first page in Google for Moz or Moz.com, we'd know something was wrong. There's a good chance Google's penalized or banned that site for spam. Fourth, if spam does link to you, Google recommends using the disavow tool system in Google Search Console, but you must be incredibly cautious because disavowing non-spam links to your site can result in massive traffic losses. Cyrus Shepard, Moz's head of SEO at the time, tested this by disavowing all the links to a site he owned, and it plummeted in the rankings. Lesson learned. Many of our interview subjects said that fear of Google penalties and the constant need to identify and validate spam versus non-spam links was driving them up the wall and consuming a lot of their SEO work time. Based on these learnings, and others I've excluded for brevity, we decided to build a spam score into our web index. This score would help indicate the degree to which a site might be perceived as spam by Google, and thus a potentially risky place from which to get or have links. The MVP process used a clever bit of research from our head of data science, Matt Peters. Long story short, Matt and I dreamed up nearly 100 potential factors that might be correlated with sites Google had penalized or banned. We then generated a large list of websites that didn't rank for their own brand or domain name, indicating they had been flagged by Google, and looked at the relative connections between all those 100 factors and the penalized or banned websites. In the end, we found 17 factors that were relatively good predictors of whether a site had drawn Google's ire. We called them spam flags, and saw in our research that the more flags a website had, the more likely it was to be penalized in Google's rankings. The flags included things like the length of the domain name. Turns out, spammers often have very long domain names. Or the presence of many external links with very little content. Having a few flags wasn't a particularly bad thing. Most websites triggered at least two or three. But if a website triggered 8 or more of the 17 flags, it was more likely than not to be penalized. The great part about Spam Score, at least for us at Moz, was that it required a relatively small amount of additional work. All in, about 3 months of effort from 5 people, though it spread out across almost a year due to overlapping priorities, to include in our data sets and to publish in our tools. We knew that initially it would receive some fair and justified criticism, and we expected folks to have concerns like, first, Moz's web index wasn't large enough at the time to cover all of the domains that may be spam, and thus couldn't provide a comprehensive list of sites to disavow with Google. Second, the percent risk model can be confusing. Many people would prefer a model that simply showed whether or not a domain was penalized by Google, rather than a percent chance tied to a count of features. But we didn't have the bandwidth to make that happen. Third, spam flags could be misconstrued as a potential problem for one's own website, rather than a filter system for reviewing links from other spammy websites. Fourth, the scores of 5 through 11 out of 17 could be particularly vexing because they indicate a higher risk of penalization, but could also be totally innocuous. And fifth, the flags weren't actually the spam signals Google uses. We don't know what those are because Google doesn't disclose them. They're simply well correlated with sites that have drawn penalties in the search engine. At launch, we figured, despite these issues, our MVP would still help a lot of people and, like all good MVPs, it would help us learn more about our customers and what they wanted from a spam-identifying product long-term. But here's the kicker. Our research had already revealed what customers wanted. They wanted a web index that included all the sites Google crawled and indexed, so it would be comprehensive enough to spot all the potential risky links. They wanted a score that would definitively say whether a site had been penalized by Google. And they wanted an easy way of knowing which of those spammy sites linked to them, or any other site on the web, so they could easily take that list and either avoid links from it or export and upload it to Google Search Console through a disavow file to prevent Google from penalizing them. That would be an exceptional product. But we didn't have the focus or the bandwidth to build the exceptional product. So we launched an MVP, hoping to learn and iterate. We figured that something to help our customers and community was better than nothing. I think that's my biggest lesson from the many times I've launched MVPs over my career. Sometimes, something is better than nothing. Surprisingly often, it's not. SpamScore launched on March 30th, 2015. And while we did receive a good bit of positive feedback, we also got a lot of criticism, confusion, and questions. The score's design was suboptimal. The way the flags aligned to a percentage risk model wasn't intuitive. Many users focused on the flag count for their own website rather than the flags of the incoming links to their sites. These were things we knew would happen in the design and construction phase, but pushed to the back burner in favor of a faster release. Marie Haynes, one of the world's foremost experts in the field of web spam and Google penalty issues, left a comment in the launch blog post that summed up a lot of the sentiment around the release. "I wanted to like this tool, but I am really concerned that it could do more harm than good. Perhaps I have misunderstood its purpose. If used as an adjunct to a manual link audit, it could be helpful. But to me, it came across as an all-in-one solution to link problems. I think that other people are going to assume this as well." We'd talked to Marie during the development of the metric. We knew her concerns. We knew she was massively influential in the space and that her approval and support, and others like her, were a great barometer for our success at solving the problem. But we chose to launch while we were still embarrassed by our first version of the product, rather than waiting until we could develop something better. Perfect is the enemy of done, right? 6 months after launch, while looking at our product performance metrics, we noted that SpamScore had become mildly popular with a small group of our customers. About 5% of the folks who regularly used Open Site Explorer visited the SpamScore section. But it had no observable impact on free trials, on vesting rate, on retention, or on growth of the Moz Pro subscription overall. In other words, we'd probably have seen exactly the same performance in our customer base and growth rate if we'd never launched SpamScore. Great use of at least $500,000 in data collection, research, and engineering time, eh? Thank God I'm the founder. Otherwise, I might have been shown the door. Do MVPs have to be so minimally viable? The problem with MVPs, and with the something is greater than nothing model, is that if you launch to a large customer base or a broad community, you build brand association with that first version. To expect your initial users, who are often the most influential early adopter types you'll attract, the same ones who will amplify the message about what you've put out to everyone else in your field, to perceive an MVP as an MVP is unrealistic. In my experience, our customers and potential customers don't see new things and think, "Oh, this must be their initial stab, and while it's not exactly what I want or need, I can see that it's a product I should pay attention to and help support, because eventually I can imagine it getting to the place where it really is useful and helpful to me." Instead, they usually see new things and think, "Is this interesting? Does it do what I need? Is it way better than what I already use? Is it worth the hassle of learning something new and switching away from what I've always done?" And if the answer to those questions is a no, or even, "Well, maybe, but I'm not quite sure," your product is unlikely to have substantive impact. Worse, I've found that when we launch MVPs, the broad community of marketers and SEOs who follow Moz perceive our quality to be shoddy and our products to be inferior. I've termed this brand reputation that follows an initially incomplete, minimally viable products launch the MVP hangover. It seems to follow the product and even the broader brand around for years, long after we've iterated and improved to make the product truly exceptional and best in class. My theory about MVPs applies differently to different stages of your organization, based mostly on reach. For an early stage company, with little risk of brand damage and a relatively small following and low expectations, the MVP model can work wonderfully. You launch something as early as possible, you test your assumptions, you learn from your small but passionate audience, and then you iterate until you've got something extraordinary. Along the way, your tiny organization is associated with an ever-improving product, and by the time large groups of influencers and potential customers hear about you, you're in great shape to be perceived as a leader and innovator. Conversely, if you already have a big following with high expectations, publicly launching a traditional MVP, one that leans more to the minimum side of the acronym than the viable side, can be disastrous. If you've reached a certain scale, which could vary depending on the reach of your organization versus the size of your field, perception and reputation are huge parts of your current and future success. A not-up-to-par product launch can hurt that reputation in the market and be perceived as a reason to avoid your company or product by potential customers. It can carry an MVP hangover for years, even if you do improve that product. And it can even drag down perception of your historic or currently existing products by association. Tesla is a great example of an early stage company that could not afford to launch an MVP. Prior to producing its first mass market available vehicle, the Tesla S, in 2008, its reputation and reach was already so vast by virtue of Elon Musk's fame and the media surrounding the formation, growth, and later government loans to the company, that anything less than extraordinary would have sundered its public perception and perhaps shuttered the organization. Or take Slack, one of the darlings of the SaaS and tech world over the last few years. Had it become publicly associated with its initial MVP group chat product, which wasn't nearly as good, as feature-rich, or as compelling in user experience as HipChat or Yammer, it's likely that it never would have achieved the great success it did. But because Slack started small, with an internal-only product that slowly spread until it was truly exceptional and ready to earn broad adoption and reach, the model of iterating internally on a minimum viable product but waiting until that product was exceptional before launching worked wonders. When Google launched in 1999, it could afford to be just like Slack, a slightly different and sometimes better version of what other search engines like Yahoo and AltaVista were at the time. But today, if you wanted to compete with Google, your search engine would have to be immensely, obviously better in order to have even an iota of a shot against it. Microsoft's Bing, when it launched in 2009, sadly wasn't massively superior, and thus, despite being an impressive effort, was generally perceived as a poor also-ran. Bing's gotten much better since then, and is now as good as or better than Google on most queries. But that MVP hangover has stuck with the brand for years, and in my opinion, continues to dampen the prospects of what should be a very decent option for web searchers. The alternative, an exceptional, viable product. My proposal is that we embrace the reality that MVPs are ideal for some circumstances, but harmful in others, and that organizations of all sizes consider their market, their competition, and their reach before deciding what is viable to launch. I believe it's often the right choice to bias to the EVP, the exceptional viable product, for your initial public release. It is, absolutely, the right move to first build an MVP. Developing every feature to perfection before you have anything people can test in the real world can be devastating. But as we saw in Chapter 11, depending on your brand's size and reach, and on the customers and potential customers you'll influence with a launch, I'd urge you to consider whether a private launch of that MVP, with lots of testing, learning, and iteration to a smaller audience that knows their beta testing, could be the best path. For Moz, it's worked out remarkably well in several of our product efforts. I'll share an example that highlights how that process can work. After the disastrous launch of Moz Analytics and the mediocre reception of SpamScore, I vowed not to make the MVP mistake again. In early 2015, I pitched Moz's executive team on a plan to build a new keyword research tool. Despite my last few product challenges, I got approval to work with a small team of 5 engineers on my proposal, with the caveat that those folks would have to continue their regular work maintaining the infrastructure, upgrades, and operations of another product. I talked to the team, and they agreed they could simultaneously support our existing workload and take on this new project. I knew that if I messed this up, it would likely be my last shot at having product ownership responsibilities at Moz. I can even recall the exact words my CEO had with me as I was embarking on it. I asked if she trusted me to do a good job on these new keyword research tools, and she replied, "I think you're good at seeing what's wrong with a product, but I don't think you're a good product designer." Those words became my mantra and my motivation over the next year. I was determined to prove to her, to my team, and to myself that I'd learned my lessons and could still make something remarkable. And yes, I realize that proving other people wrong is not an emotionally healthy form of motivation, but for me, it's always been an effective one. The new product I wanted to build would eventually be called Keyword Explorer. The goal was to help people determine what their customers and audiences were searching for online, craft lists of keyword terms and phrases to target on their websites, and prioritize those lists so they could logically know what to work on first. For example, if you're starting up a new Italian foods website and you want to help your visitors choose the best brands of fresh and dried pasta, you need to know what people type into Google when they're looking for that type of content. You also want to know which words and phrases are used more commonly than others. Do more people search for fresh pasta or dried pasta? More for best pasta brands or best pasta makers? And which of those search queries are harder versus easier to appear in? Usually determined by which other sites are already ranking in the results and how popular or important or well linked to they are. My first step was to create a slide deck in which I pitched the concept of a keyword research tool to the Moz team. I shared this first with my executive team and then with the entire company. I made 3 primary claims about why we should invest in solving the problem of keyword research. Number 1. The keyword research tool space was far less competitive at the time than other areas in which Moz had invested product and engineering resources, like links, rankings, and website crawling. Number 2. Keyword research was, and still is, the most commonly performed task in the SEO world, mostly because it's important to do every time you produce new content. Number 3. I believe that Moz had access to unique data and the ability to combine that data in ways that no other company in the world could. My research process for the pitch and the product design involved a lot of requests to my friends and colleagues in the SEO community. I asked a few dozen folks for detailed information about how they did keyword research currently and what tools and processes they applied. I sent out a pair of surveys via Twitter and BCC email blasts to get a sense of what was already popular in the field and wrote a blog post about it. Those surveys showed me which tools people were most familiar with and which ones people paid for. That gave us a huge head start in knowing what naming conventions and design layouts and existing structures our audience was already familiar with. And finally, I sat down face to face with a handful of SEO practitioners as they showed me exactly how they did keyword research for their websites or clients. Those surveys, interviews, and email conversations confirmed a few big truths. First, almost everyone who did SEO professionally used a very similar methodology for keyword research. First, they gathered a bunch of potential terms and phrases from lots of different online tools. Next, they put them all in a spreadsheet, Excel or Google Sheets, and, often manually, gathered metrics about the search popularity, relative ranking difficulty, and traffic potential. Finally, they used some version of a formula to combine the metrics and prioritize the list. Second, no existing tool performed this work automatically. Everyone had to use multiple tools and data sources alongside a manual process to build their lists. Third, a strong majority of professionals were paying for one or more keyword research tools. Fourth, the accuracy, or rather gross inaccuracy, of keyword volume data was perceived as the biggest challenge and frustration among people I surveyed and talked to. My one fear coming out of this process was that I hadn't learned much, if anything, new. All the data I'd collected and all the interviews I did merely confirmed my pre-existing suspicions. I worried that I'd somehow biased my product research. It couldn't be that my intuition was perfectly matched with reality, right? Well, maybe. In this case, I wasn't just a product designer. I was also technically my own customer. I create lots of content for the web, and I'd been doing keyword research myself for more than a decade. Like a lot of the folks I spoke to and surveyed, I too used many tools, created spreadsheets, and built my own prioritization calculations. I went to conferences and events, read blog posts, and watched industry insiders and newcomers write about, talk about, tweet about, and share their processes. I lived and breathed the life of my customers, and I think because of that, my empathy radar was especially well-tuned to this problem set. I'm still very, very glad I did the research, though, because I needed it to prove to my team what was necessary for a release-worthy tool. We started building Keyword Explorer in May 2015, initially hoping to launch by the end of the year. That slipped into January, at which point we had a workable version that included the basics. Input a word or phrase and it would analyze Google search results, suggest related search queries, return volume estimates, and enable you to easily build a list for export or analysis. I was pretty excited about the tool and went about showing it off to many of my SEO colleagues. I stayed over at Will Reynolds' house, my CEO swap friend, in January and walked him through the tool. I shared it with colleagues from Distilled, another consulting company to whom Moz has had longtime close ties. But I think the experience that triggered my change of heart came most saliently from a demo I gave to Dan Scher. Dan's an SEO consultant and well-regarded podcast host of Experts on the Wire, based in Worcester, Massachusetts. He has a sizable following in the SEO community and is particularly passionate about keyword research. Dan and I were scheduled to be at a conference together in Orlando, Florida at the end of January, just before Keyword Explorer was scheduled to launch. When I opened my laptop and showed Dan our application, I was nervous. I desperately wanted him to like what we'd built, and I knew that if he didn't, we'd have serious work ahead. I typed in a few keywords, showed him the basics, and invited him to try some of his own searches. In the good news column, the interface was intuitive. Dan picked it up right away and started building a list of keywords for one of his recent clients. He had a lot of questions about our data sources and whether he could trust the numbers we provided. He seemed mostly satisfied by my explanations, but said he'd need to double-check them against his own data and the Google search advertising campaigns his client was running. In the bad news column, Dan was underwhelmed by a number of missing features. A lack of clarity around the sources of some of the data, and the inability to filter, sort by, and view metrics he deemed critical to his keyword selection process. I showed him some of the behind-the-scenes data sources, essentially command-line-style interfaces that could surface some of the filters and information he wanted, and his eyes got wide with excitement. That night, I wrote up a lengthy email sharing the notes from my review session with Dan. I told the development team, and in a later email my executive team, that based on Dan's feedback, and several others', I wanted to delay the launch until we had released 5 more features I felt were critical to earning the reception and adoption we wanted. Frustratingly, those features would take an additional 4 months of development. We were going to be nearly 6 months late delivering the product launch. Thankfully, because Moz had so many other bets placed for 2016, and because our small team and the Keyword Explorer tool was considered a side project, less central to the company's growth plan for the year, we were granted the reprieve. From January to May, we worked tirelessly to upgrade and improve the tool. When we finally launched, it was with a product of which we could be truly proud. Those first 2 days after launch, we had just over 70,000 visits to Keyword Explorer from more than 16,000 unique visitors. Keyword Explorer was the second most upvoted product on Product Hunt the day it launched and made news on more than a dozen industry publications in the SEO and web marketing fields. Hundreds of people commented on the launch post and on social media sites, nearly all of them in an overwhelmingly positive fashion. My favorite came from Dan Scher himself, whose endorsement I wasn't sure we'd earn given his critiques back in January. Incredibly excited to see Moz's new keyword tool launched. It's a must-use for all my keyword or topic research now. That's Dan Scher's tweet on the day of Keyword Explorer's public launch. Over the next year, Keyword Explorer would become the most lauded, positively reviewed, and fastest-growing new feature by use in Moz's subscription. Our customer success team shifted much of their onboarding efforts to showcase the product, and our metrics showed that its use by customers had a strong correlation with subscribers who stuck around as paying customers versus those who quit. It wasn't an unmitigated success, though. We offered access to Keyword Explorer two ways, through the traditional month-to-month Moz subscription at $149 a month, or as a standalone product, which could only be purchased with an upfront payment of $600 or a higher tier at $1,800. The month-to-month subscriptions were significantly bolstered by the launch and the product's success, but the standalone subscriptions had almost no adoption at all. Don't underestimate the power of packaging and pricing. For me, the lesson about MVPs versus EVPs was a powerful one. In the future, I don't think I'd ever willingly, publicly release a product that leans minimum rather than exceptional, at least not with a brand that has any substantial reach. The impact of reputation and word of mouth on potential success versus the risks of MVP hangover is too important to ignore. Chapter 13. Should you sell your startup early? Yes, probably. An anti-IPO, pro-acquisition mentality plagues the tech industry and prohibits companies from hitting the long ball. That's Bill Gurley, May of 2013. Investors, media, employees, fellow entrepreneurs, startup enclaves. They push us to go big or go home. Entrepreneurship culture broadly, and the technology world in particular, glorify founders who stayed independent, turned down the big acquisition offers, and built world-changing companies as a result. Mark Zuckerberg turned down all those offers to buy Facebook. Larry and Sergey rejected early offers to buy Google. Snapchat famously said no to billions. Netflix rebuffed Amazon's millions. Slack has turned down a reported 8 to 10 acquisition offers. These stories form the popular mythos of what it means to be a founder, one that pervades the mentality of the rest of us. Getting out early with a nice payday is viewed as a fine lifestyle choice, but it's not a path to become a celebrated, legendary entrepreneur. Infuriatingly, there's an ugly flip side of the much venerated choice to stay independent. Scorn and criticism are heaped upon founders who reject acquisition offers only to see their companies plateau or decline. Groupon, Foursquare, Path, Dropbox, Yahoo, Zynga, and more have all been the subject of numerous headlines excoriating them for turning down big payouts. So here we are, as founders, stuck in the middle. Take an early exit and be branded a sellout who couldn't hack it and went for the easy money. Reject that same offer only to struggle in the years ahead, and you're an overambitious fool who recklessly turned down a sure thing. Play for the IPO path, and you face interminable struggles and the stark reality that less than 5% of VC-backed companies ever make it. What's a founder to do? Not that I don't love our 15-year-old Kia, but being a millionaire might have been fun. In our 13-year history, Moz received only one serious acquisition offer. It came over the course of 24 fateful, freezing cold hours in Washington, D.C. In 2009, as Moz was just establishing itself as a software company, I had formed a personal and professional friendship with Dharmesh Shah, a successful entrepreneur who'd previously founded and sold a company, angel investor, blogger, and co-founder of HubSpot, a Boston-based marketing software company. HubSpot and Moz were semi-competitive at the time, less so today as they've moved away from SEO to focus on other things. But that only strengthened our relationships. Shared struggles make for fast friends. And Dharmesh and I certainly had those. We spent late nights chatting on the phone about raising money from VCs, product innovations, what was happening with Google, how to choose a good board member, and, of course, personal stuff too. Geraldine and Kirsten, Dharmesh's wife, came up often in our chats, and when we found ourselves in the same city, the four of us would regularly go out for long vegetarian dinners at fancy restaurants with multi-course meals and ludicrous wine pairings. We'd spend hours talking about family, politics, books, TV shows, travel, and of course, startup life. The bill at the end was the kind that rivaled our rent payments. I think Dharmesh let us pay only once. His generosity is unbridled. I've often wondered how it is that we found ourselves lucky enough to have Dharmesh and Kirsten in our lives. As HubSpot and Moz grew, and as Dharmesh and I grew closer, it struck both of us that overlaps and opportunities for collaboration between our businesses were becoming more apparent. HubSpot became a customer of Moz's data via our API. We regularly promoted and linked to each other's content. Dharmesh spoke at MozCon, our annual customer conference in Seattle. I teased him that Moz might one day buy HubSpot, knowing that theirs was the faster growth trajectory. On one of our late-night calls in January 2011, he told me that HubSpot's leadership team had decided to try some acquisitions, and that Moz might be in consideration. Dharmesh introduced me to Brian Halligan, his co-founder and HubSpot CEO. We were both scheduled to speak at a conference in D.C. on January 24th, so Brian and I made plans to have coffee together at the event. The weather outside was so cold that the building's heat could barely keep up. I remember walking into a deserted, cavernous cafeteria, ordering a drip coffee, and waiting for Brian with my coat on. I wasn't sure how serious the discussion would be. Was this mostly a theoretical conversation about combining forces? An exploratory chat, a purely social chance to get some time together before going further? Nope. It was a straightforward, right down to business, formal offer conversation. Within minutes of Brian shaking my hand and sitting down, he laid out his plan. HubSpot was making a formal cash-in-stock offer to buy Moz. They wanted me to work on products with Dharmesh. They wanted to merge our teams. They were ready to have a Seattle presence. I'd probably have to travel to Boston a lot or maybe move there. But before we got into those details, Brian wanted to make sure the financial side of the offer would work. In 2009, Moz did $3.1 million in revenue, but almost $900,000 of that was consulting, which we closed down as a business unit to focus on software. In 2010, revenue was $5.7 million, almost all of which was from the software subscription and a little from MozCon ticket sales. We were aiming to double again in 2011 to about $10 million. Brian opened the financial discussion by saying HubSpot expected to spend in the range of $20 to $30 million. Let's take a minute to appreciate that this was an extraordinary amount of money. The startup world can make you into a highly irrational thinker with its constant news of hundreds of millions and billions of dollars changing hands and of kids in their early 20s walking away from a company after only a few years with payouts that put them easily in the top 0.1% of wealth owners. These outliers dominate the media and seem to the rest of us like the status quo. The infamous line from The Social Network should be taken as hyperbolic satire, but in Silicon Valley, it's treated almost like a mantra. $1 million isn't cool. You know what's cool? $1 billion. That's fucking insane. $1 million is plenty cool. $1 million would have meant an incredible lot to my family and me and Geraldine's if we'd had it any time in the past decade. And that's the case for more than 80% of American families. Phew. Sorry, rant over. Considering all that, I'm ashamed to tell you about the series of events that followed. I called Michelle Goldberg of Ignition Partners and Kelly Smith of Curious Office, the investors from our first and at the time only round of funding. I called my mom. I called my COO, Sarah. I talked to each of them only briefly because I had to give my presentation at the conference. Then I called them all again after. We talked through valuation scenarios and expected outcomes. We talked about the relative value of HubSpot's stock and what it might be worth in the future. At the time, HubSpot was a private company, but they were targeting an eventual public offering. We weighed the risks and the benefits, or at least we thought we did. Our logic went along these lines. First, software as a service companies like Moz and HubSpot were getting valued in private markets and recent deals in the 4 to 10 times revenue range. That is, a company doing $1 million in revenue might be bought for between $4 and $10 million. Second, while the deal would be lucrative for Moz's founders, my mom and I each owned 32.5% of the company at the time, and early employees, 12 folks each owned between 0.5% and 3%, it wasn't meaningful for our investors, who'd make back only 3 to 4 times their initial $1.1 million investment. Third, Moz was growing relatively fast, at around 100% year over year, and had a strong net margin on our revenue, about 80%, meaning that our costs for each subscriber was only about 20% of what they paid us each month. Fourth, we were unique in our market position. We're already considered a leader, if not the leader, in the field of SEO software, and thus should command a premium in an acquisition. And fifth, given our $5.7 million in revenue in 2010, trending to $10 million in 2011, an offer like Brian's was in the 4 to 5 times revenue range, and we felt we should push for a higher 6 to 8 times multiplier. Late that afternoon, I talked to Brian again. I told him we were excited about HubSpot and interested in the deal, but the money felt too low. My position was that at $40+ million, we should keep the conversation going, but below that, we weren't interested. He sent back this email the next morning. January 25th, 2011. Subject line: I don't think we can really afford you. Brian Halligan to Rand. Hi, Rand. You folks just might be too expensive for us. Eyes bigger than our stomachs. We could probably afford $25 million for y'all. If that's worth discussing, let's continue the dialogue. If not, perhaps we could have the conversation again down the road. It was great hanging out with you in D.C. Rand Fishkin to Brian. Thanks, Brian. I think we're not in the ballpark, but really appreciate you thinking of us. Congrats on the raise, and good luck with whomever you buy. I've probably pulled up that email thread 50 times in the last 6 years. 25 million dollars. 32.5% of $25 million is $8.125 million. And in 2014, HubSpot had one of the most successful IPOs of any SaaS company. Their stock has soared to great multiples since. That $25 million would have turned into a lot more. I've tried hard not to estimate it, but it's probably double that number. Maybe more. Every time I talk to my grandparents about their financial situation and how they have to sell their house and stretch their budget to afford a non-ideal retirement community, I think about that offer. Every time I visit Geraldine's mom, who has to rent out rooms in her house to make ends meet, I think about that offer. Every time my in-laws or our friends ask us why we're still renting and haven't bought a home, I think about that offer. Every time we make a charitable donation of $50 to a cause that deserves $500, I think about that offer. Every time Moz struggles, every time we face heart-rendingly hard decisions about the business, every time we miss our budget or have to scale back our ambitions, I think about that offer. In late 2011, when that New York investor pulled out of our signed term sheet for a Series B. In 2014, when, during a bout with depression, I stepped down as CEO. In 2016, when we laid off more than a quarter of our staff. Geraldine and I are not poor. Our income puts us in the top 20% of American earners. We can afford meals out and fun vacations. We've been able to help out family when they're struggling. We can pay for a nice apartment even in Seattle's ridiculously expensive rental market. Geraldine sold a book to a major publisher. We're almost 75% of the way to what we'd need for a down payment on a home in the city. But $8 million is a life-changing amount of money. And unless extraordinary things happen with Moz in the future, it's likely to be a considerable amount more than we'll make even in a successful long-term scenario because of how startup equity works. The peculiar reality of founder equity. Moz in 2016 made $42 million. 7.5 times as much money as we did in 2010. But today, thanks to 2 follow-on rounds of investment, which we were at the time thrilled to raise, Geraldine and I own about 23% of the company versus the 32.5% we owned in early 2011. It's probable that in years ahead, we'll own even less as the employee option pool, that's the percentage of stock that's distributed to folks we hire and keep at the company, increases. And as dilution from future fundraising rounds, the average successful startup raises about $42 million, and we've done $29.1 million so far, hits. Moz's investors also have what's called a liquidity preference of 1x, thankfully a very founder and employee-friendly number, meaning that upon a sale or IPO, the investors receive their money back first, the $29.1 million, and then the remaining value is split up between the remaining equity shareholders. Let's imagine that in 2020, Moz has a successful exit for $250 million, 10 times the price offered by HubSpot in 2011. Depending on dilution and ownership at the time, and on investor liquidation preference, and based on the established history that HubSpot's stock skyrocketed in value between 2011 and their 2014 IPO, it's probable that our financial return, while substantial, will not reach what that 2011 offer would have. Even that success is by no means probable. It's statistically just as likely that the company will be sold for much less, maybe only enough to cover our investors' preference. And there's a reasonable possibility of a mediocre outcome in the $75 million to $150 million range. Just saying those numbers alongside the adjective mediocre makes me feel ridiculous, but such is our environment. That makes some money for everyone, but likely wouldn't be much more than the delta between my salary the last 12 years and what I'd have made at a Google, Microsoft, or Amazon during that same period. It's fair criticism to ask why I focused on my personal financial gains.